Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Derek Dyson.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Derek Dyson to run the rule over the past week in the World Game, while our usual co-host Mike Ledgley continues his work in the Middle East preparing for next year's World Cup in Qatar. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly. And while there's plenty of news across football on the park, as always, our regular listeners will know we are committed to covering all the big stories off the field. And there was no bigger story this week than a tweet that was heard around the world from Adelaide United's Josh Cavallo, who came out as gay, making him the world's only current openly gay top-flight professional footballer. This story has made an incredible splash and will resonate for generations to come. So we'll be unpacking it as much as we can throughout the show. On the pitch, it's a double header from The Athletic. First up with Roshan Thomas from West Ham. Their giant-killing effort in the League Cup was really quite an amazing, underscore of their results so far this season, knocking off the reigning premiers Manchester City. Their season goes from strength to strength under David Moyes, fourth in the Premier League. They've won all three Europa League group games and now find themselves in the last eight of the Carabao Cup. That will be a great chat with a real character in Roshan Thomas. Of course, there's plenty of other news around the men's and women's national sides, which Willem will cover, but with the A-League men's competition kicking off in less than 3 weeks' time, this week we'll be joined by the ABC's Daniel Garb to work through it all. But of course, we'll ask Garby his thoughts on the Josh Cavallo story off the top. And our good mate from The Athletic as well, Rob Tanner, will give us a roundup on the rest of the Premier League, including his club, Leicester City, and we'll wrap it up with an extended stoppage time, as we have been wont to do in recent times with Derek as he recaps the other big stories of the week. But Derek, we will talk throughout the show about this Josh Cavallo story, but it's certainly the lead story around the world, and it's just landed with a nuclear-like explosion.
Yes, thanks, Rob. It's been interesting just to see just how that story grew and grew throughout the day.
Willem, you've got all the news off the top, including the reaction to Josh Cavallo's announcement during the week.
I certainly do, Rob, and g'day, Derek, and to all the listeners. Great to be back for another week. Adelaide United's Josh Cavallo has announced he's proud to be gay and that he's glad he can put fighting his sexuality to rest. In Australia, Cavallo follows in the path of former Newcastle Jets striker Andy Brennan, who made a similar announcement in 2019. In a video released on United's Twitter page, Josh said he'd felt growing up to both play football and be treated equally never felt a reality. And Rob, the social media response from across the world has hopefully shown Josh that that is a reality for him.
Surely it has. The reaction, as we've all seen, those of us who have looked on the Twitter feed from all of the international clubs, I'm sure you'll list them throughout the course of the show, some of the biggest names in football, people just accepting that the time has come. And for it to be an Australian story is something that I think we can be proud of.
And he's been speaking in the media left, right and centre, and it's clear in his voice he's relieved and absolutely delighted. So a big congratulations to him. Derek, I think some of the more beautiful words that have come out from across the world came from Gerard Piqué at Barcelona. He said, "I don't have the pleasure to know you personally, but I want to thank you for this step that you take. The world of football is far behind and you are helping move us forward."
Yeah, Gerard Piqué is one of the more erudite of the professional footballers, and it was good to see him along with Zlatan in only the way that Zlatan can too, and others. And look, I had goosebumps, guys, when I, you know, there's those articles that we all read where they compile all of the Twitter posts into one go and you can kind of binge through them all. And as I was reading all the comments and from all the clubs around the world, it was just absolutely fantastic.
The Matildas have provided a reminder of what a thrilling side they can be at their best, earning a win and a draw in their two friendlies with Brazil. Claire Polkinghorne netted twice across the two matches, while Sam Kerr has drawn within one goal of Tim Cahill's record for Australian international goals. Next up for the Matildas and Tony Gustafsson, hopefully a similar doubleheader against the USA next month, with the Asian Cup to come in January. Rob, I think Tony Gustafsson, this was very much needed, and he struck the chord on this one. He still brought a couple of youngsters through, Remy Seamson and Briley Henry on their debuts, but he largely relied on that settled core. We're less than 100 days out from the Asian Cup, as Steph Brandt sort of called for last week, and Mary Fowler and Kyra Cooney-Cross, although young, are very much part of that settled group now.
Tony Gustafsson, You know, he had the courage and the strength of character to make the decisions that needed to be made. And look, hats off to the Matildas on the field. I mean, there was all sorts of pressure, and they said there was none, but surely there was. I mean, this story was resonating for a couple of weeks prior to it, and you know, they were all very emotionally connected to what was being reported in the news. And you know, I hate to use the jargon marketing term brand in all of this, but they're proud of what the Matildas represent to Australia and to international football, and for any number of reasons, it had been tarnished, and they set their rights to rectify that the only way that they could, by reacting on the park against you know, one of the world's leading football nations. And it was a great couple of weeks, and you know, hats off to Tony Gustafsson and everyone around the Matildas for doing an incredible job.
Former Rangers, Everton and Scotland manager Walter Smith has passed away aged 73. Smith won 21 titles across two stints with Rangers, including the latter five of seven consecutive league titles in the 90s and their final title until this year in 2011. Smith played over 200 games for Dundee and served as Alex Ferguson's assistant with Scotland at the 86 World Cup. Derek, he also had a four-year spell with Everton. All up, he won 10 Scottish leagues, five Scottish Cups and six League Cups. But judging by the reaction, he left far more of an impact on Scottish football than just those raw numbers.
Some of our older listeners will know that the Rangers dominance that came before the Celtic dominance that we've experienced over the past decade or so. And Walter Smith was absolutely at the centre of that. He put together some fantastic teams that included the likes of Paul Gascoigne, Ali McCoist, Mark Hateley, Gordon Drury, Andy Gorham, amongst others. And they were not just a dominant team in Scotland, but we're also having some pretty handy results in Europe as well. And Ferguson is a pretty good comparison. They were great mates. They come cut from a similar cloth. And yeah, he is one of the greats as gone.
Sunderland, West Ham and Arsenal have caused major boilovers in the League Cup, progressing to the quarterfinals on Wednesday. The Black Cats, with Bailey Wright in the heart of defence, drew nil-all with QPR before advancing on penalties, as did West Ham, who hosted Manchester City. Okay, Derek, Arsenal, that wasn't a boilover at home to Leeds. Yeah. 2-0 winners they were, and fair enough. The other teams to advance were Tottenham, Liverpool, Leicester, Brentford and Chelsea. But it is most certainly Sunderland and West Ham who were the stories there. The Black Cats down and out on their lockdown in League One. And Derek, looking forward to having Roshan Thomas on a little bit later on to chat about the Hammers.
The League Cup is now wide open. You know, Manchester City might as well just have given them the trophy because they've won it for the last 4 years. And it's not a fancy trophy and not one that you'd expect a club like Manchester City, who have, you know, let's face it, more loftier aspirations when it comes to the cups that they win. But this is an enormous scalp for West Ham. Guardiola will be disappointed, and everyone who's in the hat, including Arsenal, will be just thinking that cup could just be a little more possible.
Ronald Koeman has been sacked as Barcelona boss. The league lost to Rayo Vallecano, proving the last straw for President Joan Laporta. Barca sit ninth in the league and failed to score in their first two games of a European campaign for the first time ever. They currently sit third in their Champions League group. Early names in the mix for his replacement include Xavi and Roberto Martinez. If I was club legend Xavi, still relatively young in my managerial career, I'll be staying away from that poison chalice. And Rob, I don't want to say I told you so about Ronald Koeman, but I think if you go back and listen to Box to Box August 2020, I might have said this would happen. I now place him firmly in the box seat to take over the Dutch national team ahead of the 2022 World Cup, given the joke of a merry-go-round of past legends. They continue to cycle through that job.
Well, I'm for such a young man, it's
so cynical.
A very cynical view you take of your, the national side of your heritage. And you can say, I told you so. If you predicted it, I don't mind people sort of cashing in their predictions and knowing exactly what date they made them, which seems to suggest that you actually made a record of the date that you did it. But no, you did set right. And Koeman survived probably a lot longer than many people thought that he would. It is time to go. Look, there are only two wins off the top. I mean, it's a very cluttered top end of La Liga. Not suggesting that a new manager is going to turn it around, but there's still plenty of time to get it done because the La Liga is as competitive as it's ever been. So there is time if the right person is appointed to take over and can get a tune out of the current squad.
And finally, Ellen Stajcic has returned to international women's football, signing as manager of the Philippines women's side. The Malditas, as they are known, which translates to the Feisty Ladies, are ranked 68th in the world and have qualified qualified for the Asian Cup. And would you believe it? They have drawn the Matildas. Yes, the Matildas against the Malditas. You just couldn't make this stuff up. Also in the group, Rob, is Thailand and Indonesia.
That's a huge signing, and there'll be certainly some scores to settle as Stajic goes about his work with the Philippines. And as we've discussed so many times on this show, the people of Southeast Asia are passionate about their football and they are improving at a pace. I'd suggest that that there's obviously some forward-thinking people in Philippine football, and Stajic is not the sort of bloke that just needs to jump on a job, so he must see something there. So that will be fascinating to see when the Philippines take on the Matildas. Well, in the not too far distant future, yeah, we are sitting on the edge of my seat for that one. All right, Willem, well done. That's a great start to the show. After the break, we are going to talk to Roshane Thomas, one of the great characters of international journalism. He's a genuine character, and as I was listening to the League Cup penalty shootout against Manchester City, I was thinking that the Olympic Stadium might just be called New Upton Park in the fullness of time, because that 60,000 crowd almost raised the roof. So it's finally earning its soul as a venue for the true West Ham fans. We'll chat to Roshane Thomas after the break about all that next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. And of the many clubs who have been doing well this Premier League season in the UK, one of the great stories that's emerging is around David Moyes' West Ham. We thought they did well last season, and when Jesse Lingard went back to Manchester United, we thought maybe, you know, one of their X factors is gone, but they've covered it all just nicely and beat Manchester City in the League Cup just this last couple of days. And the man on the beat for the Athletic, Roshane Thomas, was there to see it all. Roshane, is it too soon to say that the Olympic Stadium, that potentially New Upton Park, has finally started to earn its soul?
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely starting to feel like home for West Ham fans now. And I'll probably say the match where you sort of think, you know what, it actually feels like home, was their game against Rapid Vienna in the Europa League, the 2-0 win. Because before that match, we had the light show. So everyone was taking the light show, you know, the fireworks, all that sort of stuff. And the atmosphere was incredible during that match. It was so good. And obviously last night, it'll be in a win against Man City in a penalty shootout. Atmosphere is incredible once more. And Moyes always said he wants to make the stadium a fortress. And I think we're starting to see that now from West Ham.
Wasn't a classic West Ham side, Roshane. They were missing a few players. Antonio, for example, they had Yarmolenko up front. But it was a scrappy game, but ended well for West Ham. But what did they get right against City?
My main takeaway from that match was the belief. They had the belief they could beat Man City, as you mentioned in the first half. Quite lucky to still be in the game, really, considering the amount of chances Man City had. But the fact it was still nil at half time, it gave the players, you know, encouragement that they could actually get a result from this game. And then the more the second half went on, the game started to open up more. And then we saw Fornals enter the field, Bowen Benrahma, and we saw West Ham create a lot more chances. And I think that's been a massive difference over the past 20 months, that the culture has changed at West Ham in terms of there being a winning mentality, the team being very resilient, you know, everyone having each other's back. And we saw that yesterday, for example, when Benrahma scored the winning penalty, he ran to the crowd and he was embraced. Let's say a year ago, West Ham fans were like, Benrahma, when are you going to finally deliver? When are you going to finally show us the performances we saw when you played for Brentford? So everything's coming together so well. And listen, Moyes and the coaching staff have definitely transformed the club for sure.
Yeah, let's talk about Moyes for a second, because there are other managers in the league who are under fire at the moment. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been in the press for the wrong reasons after the result against Liverpool. They've been questioning his coaching. Mikel Arteta, Arsenal, to a lesser extent, you know, not necessarily celebrated managers that have been brought in. Moyes was kind of written off before the West Ham job when they brought him back. But is this a man that's reinventing himself in the West Ham job? Because the perception from his Everton day certainly was a good organiser, a good sort of defensive setup. But this isn't what we're seeing at West Ham, is it?
Yeah, for sure. I wouldn't even say kind of written off. He was completely written off. Completely written off. Fans were like, why on earth are we reappointed David Moyes as manager? Some even gone as far as calling him a dinosaur. That's how bad it was. That's what people thought of David Moyes at the time. And look, over the past 20 months, he's completely changed the club. He's enhanced his reputation. Last season, in fact, he was in contention for the LMA Manager of the Year award, which obviously went to Pep. In actual fact, after the match, last night's game, I asked Pep about what's his thoughts on West Ham's progress. And he said, you know, fantastic team, a fantastic manager. And it's great to see David Moyes get the respect he deserves because he's always been a good manager. But obviously, as we all know, it didn't work out for him at Sociedad. It didn't work out for Man United. It didn't work out for Sunderland. But that's how it goes in life. Sometimes you go through phases where things don't go well, but all you've got to do is have that self-belief. And that's what David Moyes has always had. And I'm working on a big read right now on David Moyes ahead of his 1,000 managerial game. Pretty much spoke to all the players that he coached at Everton, and Fellaini was saying, listen, all David Moyes needs is time. Once he gets time to build a squad, then he's just, you know, one of the best managers in the league, really. And we're seeing that now at West Ham.
Newcastle is a club, obviously, that's transformed under new ownership. How about the West Ham ownership? I read some stories recently about a consortium that looking at buying the club that Gold and Sullivan are kind of holding firm, and partly because obviously the renaissance of the club in recent years, suddenly being the owner of West Ham is suddenly really exciting again. But with this new consortium that's talking about buying the stadium, regenerating the area, where do West Ham sit in terms of ownership? Do the fans want to change?
But that consortium you just mentioned now is Pi Capital. And in all honesty, West Ham fans, they aren't convinced. They're like anything but Pi Capital right now, because they've come out quite a few times and engaged with the media. And they've mentioned stuff like wanted to build a training ground next to the stadium, wanted to, you know, build hotels. And fans don't care about that. All they care about is how you're going to improve and invest in the team, how you're going to back David Moyes. And right now, they're pretty much stances that we'd rather have the current owners than have someone like Pi Capital in charge. So, look, the owners don't ever universally be popular among supporters. That's just how it goes, unfortunately. In fact, I think it was before the Brentford game, but a small protest. So there's still a large section of fans that want the owners out. But look, it's West Ham right now. It's a bit like Bitcoin. If we don't invest now, the stock's going to keep going up, you know. So I'd imagine other people will be looking at West Ham and thinking, you know what, that's actually a good club. I'll try and invest in that. So who knows what happened in the long term in terms of West Ham having any owners. But in the short term, the owners have got it right when it comes to, you know, being in the background and allowing David Moyes and the coaching staff to, you know, get the best out of the club right now.
Yeah, well, they're definitely one of the clubs that's got a massive international following. There's a huge supporters organisation for West Ham in this country, as we know there are in many other countries. So, you know, they could be just one of those clubs waiting to genuinely explode if they can get all of the elements together and find themselves a regular position in the top six. Roshan, we know you're a popular man right now and you've got other commitments. better get off to those as well, mate. So thank you for joining us for a quick chat about West Ham. We'll get you on again, hopefully in a month or so's time, and just watch this story play out over the course of the season.
For sure. Yeah, thanks for having me on, and always great chatting to you guys.
Excellent. Roshan Thomas from The Athletic, West Ham. What a great story that is emerging to be. All right, stick around. Break. Daniel Garb, we're going to talk Socceroos, Matildas. We're going to talk Josh Cavallo as well in some detail, because Daniel has got some good reflections on the international and local reaction to the Josh Cavallo announcement. Stick around. That's all next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Now, we covered the story extensively off the top of the show, but Josh Cavallo's announcement as the first openly gay male top flight professional footballer will resonate for many, many years to come. We are obviously going to talk about the Socceroos, Matilda, some A-League as well, but we've got Daniel Garb on the line from the ABC. And Daniel, it came out of the blue. It was a tweet that Josh put out under his own name and under his own conditions. Mm. What was your immediate reaction and then reaction to the reaction around the world?
Yeah, immediate reaction was just to applaud him for being so brave and for taking that step, not only for himself. I mean, that was the most important aspect, of course, because we all read his description. He was going through torment for 6 years, you know, struggling to deal with living a double life almost, you know, being scared of what the reaction would be inside a football club. And that must be very horrible for someone to go through. So he must feel just so relieved, and that's great. And then the reason to do it so publicly is so important, because to not have a gay male footballer anywhere in the world professionally, To me, that's not possible statistically. It's just not the case, which means there are players who have been scared to come out. And it's not just football. It's other codes as well. I mean, I'm sure you all follow the AFL closely. There's never been an openly gay player in the VFL/AFL in its history. Again, statistically, that's not possible. There has to have been. It would shock me if there's not one now, but they don't feel comfortable enough to come out and say it. So it's important to lay the pathway for that, and not only for sports people. I mean, yes, the world has changed a lot, and being gay right now is normal, and everyone's accepting of it, but it would still be a difficult thing, I can imagine, to come out and actually do. You still hear of people who struggle to tell their family and to tell their friends and battle with that for years, and how difficult that must be. Again, this happening so publicly, I'm sure makes it a lot easier for other people. And I've seen comments from people who are openly gay who have said on Josh Cavallo's Twitter and Instagram, you've actually saved people's lives here. And those people would know what it's like to go through. So I just applaud him for that. And it's fantastic that it's connected to Australian football, because the reaction from around the world has been gobsmacking. I mean, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, Rio Ferdinand, Antoine Griezmann, Gerard Piqué, Pau Gasol, Gary Lineker, the Premier League, every single big club. It's been mind-blowing. So good on him. He's a great ambassador for the Australian game at the moment.
Yeah, it has been incredible. And you mentioned the AFL, the only NRL player that's come out of a high-profile, Ian Roberts, whose career straddled the 80s and 90s. It didn't open the floodgates.
Yeah, exactly. That's the funny thing. Like, when that happened, right, you would have thought, I guarantee people said back then, by the time 2021 comes around, a player announcing that they're gay won't even register because it'll be so normal. Well, it hasn't, right? So clearly this stuff needs to happen, these public announcements, so that it can resonate.
And Daniel, from a media standpoint, this wasn't just announced off a whim. It was obviously quite seriously orchestrated with a full video and open letter. Josh himself has been on Media Street taking up any request that's come his way. So clearly he personally has taken this very seriously and understands the weight of what he's done in our society as it stands right now. Hopefully we'll move to a point where that weight isn't attached to it. But for now, he clearly understands the weight of what he's done.
Yeah, exactly. And he's a smart kid. And he understands how important it is. And I don't think for a second it's about him wanting the attention. I think it's about him realizing that he can affect people's lives in a positive way and make a big change in sport and society in that sense, and make it easier for other people in a similar situation to him. So, yeah, I think it's all been handled really well.
Time for Socceroos and Matilda Central, guys. And Daniel, what a pleasure it is to have you for this part of the show. We are under 400 days away from the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. And now is the time to register your interest in the Green and Gold Army's World Cup Tour. You can do this at ggatravel.com.au. I thought we'd first touch on a retirement that's caught a few by surprise over the past 7 days or so, that of Adam Federici at MacArthur, made all the more strange by the fact that less than a month ago he was handed the captaincy, and yeah, now he's retired. Daniel, he left a significant mark at Reading, where he played 245 games across just under a decade. He also spent time at Stoke and Bournemouth, and I'm pretty sure that coincided with your time in the UK. 31 games all up in the Premier League. What sort of mark did he leave in the English football system?
I'm quite sure he was named in Reading's Team of the Decade when they announced it a few years ago. That sums it up. I mean, he was a top-class keeper who was another one to, unfortunately, be at his peak when the likes of Mark Schwarzer were, and then when Matt Ryan came through. So didn't quite get the chance to establish himself in the Socceroos, but a top-quality keeper, following in the line of many others in Australia who flew the flag well for us overseas, and last year showed that he was as good as anyone in the A-League, probably the best keeper in the A-League. So a shame that it's been an abrupt retirement, but he's had a wonderful career.
On the pitch this week, it was another cracker for Jackson Irvine and St. Pauli, who scored his first goal for the club in the league in a 4-0 win over Hansa Rostock, so they've established themselves at the top of the table for the time being. Jackson then went on to play a full match as the side progressed in the cup. In the championship, Riley McGree was also in the score sheet for the first time this season, netting the winner off the bench in a 2-1 win over Swansea. Daniel, Riley is contracted to head to Charlotte in the MLS in January. I think everyone in Australia would prefer that our footballers pursue a career in England. Obviously, it's not our choice, but that's generally the way things go. He hasn't quite bedded down a starting position at Birmingham, and the clock does seem to be ticking. So how do you think this will play out over the next 6 months?
I reckon he stays there. I mean, a young player of that talent scoring goals now, I'm a big Riley McGree fan. I reckon whenever he's asked to play at a higher standard, he usually rises with it. I'd be surprised if he goes to Charlotte. Maybe contractually he's held to that. But you'd think Birmingham would be trying to come to some arrangement to keep him there, and you'd think that he would want to stay in the Championship. You know, considering the way he's going right now, hopefully that's the case.
Certainly hope so. To Japan, Adam Taggart has finally found the net for Cerezo Osaka in their Emperor's Cup win over Mitch Langerak's Nagoya. 3-0 they beat them. Adam scored the last one there. Nagoya also got done 4-0 in the Champions League recently, so I'm not sure what's happened to that famous defence. Daniel, Jamie McLaren, you'd expect will be available for the upcoming November qualifiers if, as we hope, the Socceroos can return to home soil. Adam's been... he's had the run over to the last little while. He hasn't scored. I think he's played quite well, a more sacrificial, deeper role. And I think Arnie will... I'm a big Adam Taggart fan. I'll put it on the table. So hopefully Arnie will see it the same. How do you see it? It's always a good debate with these two across their careers.
Well, he's got the inside running because McLaren's not playing. I mean, it's, again, that international window time of the year where the A-League players aren't in full match conditioning yet. And so you've got to go with Taggart. You have to. Mitch Duke's the other one who's, you know, been in pretty good nick over the last few months, did a decent job leading the line at the Olympics. But I think Taggart's the one you stick with considering the football he's playing week in, week out without the A-League season starting. Once McLaren gets a run on, different story. And then I think Jamie McLaren's probably the favourite. But as it stands right now, I think Adam Taggart leads the line again. You know, the only issue might be is if he goes for someone like a Martin Boyle and then wants to play, you know, Owen Mabil on a wing. He was obviously left on the bench against Japan. Martin Boyle, I think, can play as a central striker. But I'd say at home to Saudi Arabia, Adam Taggart's the favourite.
No, I like your thinking. I certainly like it. Moving on to the primary reason we got you on, Daniel, the A-League is less than a month away. The pre-season for all clubs are well and truly underway, and the bulk of imports are here. There's been a few come in that have been of huge profile, such as Daniel Sturridge, a few less so. So let's start with Perth Glory. It does feel like there's been a big shift in intent for Richard Garcia's second season. Diego Castro out, what a legacy he's left, and Sturridge in. So can you quickly reflect, or take as long as you like, really, on Castro's impact in the 6 years he had in the league and what we can expect from Daniel Sturridge?
I mean, one of the greatest the A-League has had, pure and simple. And I would have him as the second best Perth Glory player ever behind Bobby Despotovsky, Diego Castro.
Yep.
Just an ornament to the competition and one of the perfect marquees who comes with an excellent reputation and ends up staying for a long period of time. That's the ideal scenario. And then, you know, builds an affinity with the supporters. He's been wonderful. And a shame that it's ended this way, but you can understand why. Not sure when Daniel Sturridge is getting here. He needs to quarantine still. So could be leaving it a little late for the start of the season. But it's so exciting to have a player of that quality who seems to be fit and motivated coming to the competition. He's going to be the major storyline when the season starts. He's going to be hugely dependent on his form in terms of the Glory's progress because I think he is important for them in that sense. Love the signing of Brandon O'Neill. We forget how integral he was for Sydney FC. He played for the Socceroos. He's been named captain of the club today. I think he's a key man for them in terms of their fortunes this season as well.
And rumours have popped up once again that Tony Sage might be thinking about pulling the pin with Mark McGowan's WA state borders firmly shut for another little while. No one can question Tony's commitment or his financial investment in the club, but it does just, it seems a little incongruous that you'd pursue something like Sturridge and then not stick around to see the fruit. Is there anything you can maybe enlighten us to around that?
If I had a dollar for every time Tony Sage threatened to pull the pin on the Glory, I reckon I could buy the Glory. So, he does this a lot. I do feel for him, though. He's pouring a lot of money in. The club's losing money. He's looking for a buyer. He had the cryptocurrency bloke. That never worked out.
No.
He, that was a shambles. He's desperate for someone else to come in, but then he goes and invests in Daniel Sturridge and he'll play one game at home and be on the road for 5 weeks. And they're not sure when they'll be able to open those borders and have teams over in Perth. I do feel for him. He's trying to do the right thing. He always does. His ego sometimes gets the better of him, but he puts his money where his mouth is as well. And he doesn't seem like he's getting much help. So, well, I don't think he'll pull the pin. I have a lot of sympathy with Tony.
Down to Melbourne, two big signings that could make or break the seasons of these respective clubs. Western United and John Aloisi parted way with Bezar Berisha, and they brought in Serbian Aleksandar Prijavic to fill the striking position there. He's won trophies everywhere he's gone, Poland, Greece and Switzerland, and he played at a World Cup as recently as 2018. And across down at Melbourne Victory, Tony Popovic has brought in Francesco Margiotta. Now, Daniel, you played newsbreaker on that one to a large extent. Having had a look through Margiotta's stats, plenty of Serie C, Serie B. He's only scored 10 goals in a season once. So what is it about those raw numbers that I'm not getting, because the hype certainly seems to be there?
Look, he's still young enough. I think he's only 30. So that's exciting. Again, we just don't know with these foreigners. I mean, Bruno Fornaroli didn't have great stats before he came to Australia. He hadn't done anything. But sometimes there's something about Australia and the environment and the climate and the pitches and the clubs that brings the best out of them. There's other players who come with great reputations and don't click for whatever reason. You know, it's just, that's just football. Some players just, you know, somehow find their best form in our competition, which is great. Others are quality players who don't. So, Margiotta, hopefully, Bruno Fornaroli. You know, Western United, I think I've found one. I think he's got an excellent CV, and I think John Aloisi is building a nice squad there. We know they are nomadic and they'll be all over the place. And again, that's likely to be the biggest issue for them. But I like Johnny A as a coach. It is make or break for him now. He has to get this right. I think he will. I'm bullish on him. I think this will be a period that that he enjoys. And he's got together a nice group of players. So I'm hopeful it all works out. And I think their striker can be a damaging one. I think he'll be the tip for the golden boot for many.
And Daniel, before we let you go, a more broad comment on the A-League in general. We've got the new broadcaster kicking in. They've started off with some international football, which has been well received so far. A few tweaks to some of the optics of the presentation have been made, but all round it seems to be going pretty well. We're hoping that they'll showcase both A-League men's and women's in their primetime programs. We've seen a few of the big matches get shuffled off to the digital channel of Bold, which was a little bit of a surprise. But we're 3 weeks away from the kickoff of the men's competition. So what do you know about crowds in Melbourne? Because, you know, Melbourne City, Brisbane Roar open at Amy Park on Friday the 19th of November. We haven't heard any announcements just yet. So what's your thoughts on the potential for a crowd and also the A-League under the new broadcaster and what you're expecting?
Well, they're talking about big crowds for the Melbourne Cup and that, aren't they? So if that's the case, it has to be for the A-League as well.
I think so.
You would think so. Double vaccinated, of course, but I would imagine that'll be okay in Victoria. It's been great in Sydney. I went to both Matilda's games, reporting on them, and it was just wonderful to see the, you know, over 10,000 people for both of those matches. Wonderful atmosphere in an awesome stadium. So the Socceroos game, November 11, that will be big as well. And the broadcasters, I think they took a jump up with the Matilda's games. I was really impressed with their coverage of that. You know, the Socceroos games, they're still, they've got those teething issues. They're getting into it. I think they're going to, you know, ramp things up a little bit when the A-League starts again in that big Socceroos game on November 11. But the Matildas matches, I thought, looked pretty slick on the TV, and the graphics and the team look good. So, yep, the free-to-air games are huge. They are massive for the code. There is obviously concerns about the games that will be on the streaming app and behind that paywall and how many people are watching that. It's a bit different to when you're sitting at home and you're just flicking through Foxtel, and, oh, there's an A-League game on, I'll watch a bit of this. Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. There won't be as much of that, which is a concern, but the Channel 10 game on Saturday night, where there'll be another game on at the same time that they'll be crossing to in that almost goal zone kind of way, that's going to be powerful for the game. And then hopefully it builds on that, you know. It's not just all about how it goes in the first month. It might take a year or two, and then people catch on and say, well, I'll get a subscription. I'm enjoying the A-League. So it might be a bit of a slower burn. But the Socceroos games are big as well. And those World Cup qualifiers, there'll be big crowds. There'll be big ratings for those. People realise how enormous those contests are. And Saudi Arabia, November 11, that's just a monumental clash. So that'll be another big one for them too.
Yeah, it is massive. And look, I've got the Paramount app already. And for those of us who've had Optus for many years after a slow start back in the World Cup in Russia, they've come a long, long way. The expectation of that streaming service amongst football fans is extremely high. And At the moment, Paramount just isn't quite there because it's combined with other content that they're streaming as well. So hopefully the right people listening and the right football people who understand the expectations, because people won't stick around for long. There's just too much competition in the world of streaming these days to think that someone's going to stick with an app or a streaming service that doesn't provide first-rate content and user interaction and interface.
Yeah, exactly right. So they need an 8 alert and hopefully they will, but... yeah, I think there's a lot of positives there to be excited about.
Yeah. Hey, Daniel, thanks so much for joining us, mate. We'll get you back on again as the A-League rolls around. It's always good to hear your thoughts and on a momentous week in football with the Josh Cavallo story. You've been front and centre in all of that, mate. And it's just wonderful news, a positive story for all of us to reflect on rather than some of the other stories we've been working through in recent times.
No worries. Good stuff, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. Daniel Garb from the ABC, one of the genuinely, seriously respected voices of football in this country. All right, stick around. Rob Tanner from The Athletic is next. We took Roshan Thomas earlier on, but we're going to talk Leicester City, how they're going, but more broadly, the Premier League. Now, the crowds have been back for a couple of months, how the reaction has been in the UK and around the world. That's next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Now, we talked to Roshan Thomas about the rise and rise of West Ham under David Moyes, but the steady progression, they just seem to be a fixture at the top of the ladder now under Brendan Rodgers, Leicester City. And when they're not in the top six, it's more of a surprise these days. And our go-to man, as we always have gone to since we started the show, is The Athletic's Rob Tanner. How are you, Rob?
I'm good, thank you, guys. How are you?
Yeah, really good. And I guess that point around expectation now, I mean, we're now expecting Leicester to sit in that area of Champions League qualification. I mean, we know the disappointment of the last two seasons, failing at the final hurdle, but, you know, winning into the final eight of the League Cup against, you know, pretty stiff opposition, albeit at home. The expectations must be there every single week, regardless of who they play.
Oh, they're absolutely enormous now, the expectations. And there are a section of the Leicester fans that think it's their God-given right now to be challenging in the top, which I think has been a minor miracle in itself over the last couple of years. When you consider the revenue stream coming into the club and the budget compared to... I mean, they haven't even got as big a budget as West Ham and Everton. And those are the clubs that they're sort of competing on a level playing field with, not Arsenal and Man United, Man City, Chelsea, Liverpool and Tottenham. It's it really is a fantastic achievement in itself, even though the disappointment of dropping out of the Champions League places in the final week of the last two seasons has sort of created a bit of a hangover going into this season, I felt. Certainly, it's been a very stuttering start, but although in the last few weeks they've started to find their form again.
What do you put the kind of the sluggish start to the season down? Was it injuries, or was it the come down maybe from the kind of the end of last season, winning a major trophy like the FA Cup?
Both. I would absolutely put it down to both of those. I'm not just the injuries going into this season, but the legacy of the injuries from last season, because they managed to stay in the top four for nearly all the season, despite an absolutely terrible record with injuries. They lost so many key players. I mean, Harvey Barnes went as well with a knee operation. I mean, James Justin with his ACL. And then they come into this season and they've got the plantar fasciitis injury that plagued Johnny Evans and forced him off at Wembley in the FA Cup final. And then Wesley Fofana had a terrible broken leg in the final pre-season game. So injuries really started to mount up and take their toll. And it looked like as well, mentally, there was a lack of confidence. As I said, probably a hangover of the fact that again, for the second season running, the disappointment of missing out on Champions League football, which is so important when you consider the likes of Yuri Tielemans is stalling over signing a new contract, and it's because he wants to play, you know, Europeans elite competition. And Leicester look like they can't give him that at the moment. But I think the biggest issue in terms of the turnaround, though, has been Brendan Rodgers trying to find a solution to the conundrum of the players that he did have available and how to play without Johnny Evans. And he's gone with a back three. And that has been the trigger that's really kick-started them. And you've seen the likes of Maddison now coming back into form. Harvey Barnes scored last night against Brighton as well. So some of the players are starting to find their form again. And also, it helps him get Kelechi Iheanacho and Jamie Vardy in the same side, which he was reluctant to do because he likes to play with one striker. But when you have two players up front, they're in such great form, you've got to play them.
With City out of the frame, with West Ham dumping them out, I mean, Leicester are a bit of a cup team. Will they be looking at this tournament now, thinking quarterfinals, no Manchester City? There's maybe a chance there.
Absolutely, Will. Yeah, especially getting to the last eight now again. I mean, it's a competition that they got to the semi-finals a couple of years ago, lost surprisingly at Aston Villa. Obviously, then winning the FA Cup last year. Silverware is what it's about for Brendan. I mean, previous managers have not taken this competition too seriously. And even last night, you could argue, Brendan's fielded a very much changed side, but he's still got players who are playing in form. I mean, Patson Daka, I mean, if you saw his performance in the Europa League in Moscow, it was incredible. To come on and score a hat-trick in 9 minutes, the fastest hat-trick in Europa League history. He's penciled in to be Jamie Vardy's successor and to give him another run out, give him more confidence as well. It's been excellent for Brendan. Everything's gone right, whereas everything was going wrong in the early part of the season. The last couple of weeks, everything's been going right for him.
Going back to the league, the next assignment is Arsenal. And Arsenal and Leicester have very, very decent matches, and it's a bit to and fro, but Jamie Vardy again has started the season excellently. It just seems to be evergreen. He just, you know, we just don't know where this guy is actually going to dip, and he'll be licking his lips a bit because Arsenal is a team he likes to play, Rob.
It is. We'll have to keep a check on the knee injury, which forced him off at a half time at the weekend, and see how serious that is for Jamie, because he started the season in incredible form. 7 goals in the first 8 Premier League games. He's 34 years old. He's a freak of nature. I mean, you'll never come across a striker or a player like him for his longevity, considering, you know, what his lifestyle used to be like and the fact that he came into the Premier League at such an old age compared to the youth that are coming through and establishing themselves, coming through the academy route. I mean, he's coming through non-league, living on dripping sandwiches, working in a factory. And then he signed for £1 million, and away we go. And we all know his story now, and it is being made into a Hollywood blockbuster because it's that remarkable. He would love to play against Arsenal, and people don't realise how close he came to joining them after the title-winning season in 2016 when they came in and triggered his release clause. You know, he met the club, he met executives, he was going to go. But then he just, something didn't feel right for him. He decided that he wanted to stay at Leicester because he felt he owed the club who had taken such a risk in signing him from non-league. So he could have been wearing an Arsenal shirt for the last 5 years. But luckily for Leicester, he decided to stay. And what a fantastic performer he's been for them.
Brendan Rodgers was under a little bit of pressure at the start of the season. And of course, Rob, there's kind of uncertainty with Rodgers too, because he's been there for a little while, probably quite a while, for in terms of Premier League manager stakes. Every time a manager gets released of their job, that Rodgers is always one of the names, that the revolving door of names that comes back again and again and again, along with Eddie Howe and people like that. How do Leicester manage that expectation, do you think, as a club? And where do you think Rodgers' head is at right now when it comes to Leicester?
I think he's very happy at Leicester. I mean, he's looking at the long-term projects. They've submitted the planning application for the redevelopment of King Power Stadium and the surrounding area. I mean, it's going to be phenomenal. It looks like Wembley Way, the things they've got planned there. And he did say that he wants to be the manager for the long term. He's been linked with so many jobs. It's almost disrespectful to Leicester in many ways, that everybody seems to think another job is better than the job he's got at Leicester. But, you know, he's got a new £100 million training ground as his office. He's got ambitious owners that are backing him, supporting him. You saw the scenes when they won the FA Cup at Wembley on the pitch, when he had Kuntop on the pitch to celebrate that. But look, the reality is, Leicester got him from Celtic, a massive club, where he won trophy after trophy. He wanted to come and test himself. So when he feels there's a new challenge on the horizon, then he's ambitious enough, he'll take it. But what that challenge will be, I mean, I woke up this morning to news of Ronald Koeman being sacked at Barcelona. I think that would be his dream job. I don't think Barcelona will come in for Brendan, and whether it's the right time to go to Barcelona as well with all the problems they've got there. But I think that would be a job that would tempt him. But I don't think the Tottenham job or the Newcastle job would be a tempter for him at the moment.
And Rob, you mentioned Kuntop in your previous response. Of course, Leicester City fans and players paid a tribute to their former owner, Vishai Srivaddhanaprabha, on the third anniversary of that helicopter crash. It just, time goes so fast, doesn't it?
It does, it does. A horrendous night, and it was such a touching tribute to Vishai. I mean, his legacy still is being felt in Leicester now with the money they spent on the local hospice, the hospitals, the children's ward. You know, it's named in his honour. And the plans I just mentioned for the King Power Stadium, I'm sure there's going to be a fitting tribute included in there to him as well. You know, his legacy is seen, is felt all around Leicestershire. Even if you're not a Leicester City supporter, you or somebody you know will have benefited from his generosity and the charity that the club have been so fantastic with over the last, well, 10 years since they came in. And his son is carrying that on. And also on the pitch as well, with, you see the investment, £55 million again spent on new players in the summer, and the plans they have for the training ground and the stadium as well. So, yeah, he's much missed, but never forgotten.
And the irony is not lost on us on the textbook of what an owner of a club, a foreign owner of a club, should be in the light of stories of recent times. So all football fans will know exactly what I'm talking about there. We won't go down that rabbit hole for the moment, but in terms of other Premier League stories, there is a match this weekend at the new White Hart Lane where, if it wasn't for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's woes, you'd think that Nuno Espirito Santo might be in a little bit of trouble himself, sitting outside the top six. This is a season-defining match for both clubs, but it could also be a coach killer for Ole if Spurs have their way and United can't bounce back from that shocking loss against Liverpool on the weekend. How do you read that, Rob?
Yeah, I think United are reluctant to sack Ole. But I think if they continue to perform the way they're performing, it'll become inevitable. They don't want to do it, because traditionally United are a side that try and give managers a bit of time. I mean, they learnt that lesson from Sir Alex Ferguson's reign, when he had such a difficult start to his tenure and then went on and had such fantastic success over a number of years. But I think people are looking at it, and I certainly watched that Liverpool performance when they were all over the place, and I saw them live against Leicester, and defensively again they were woeful, and that's down to organisation, a lot of it, and you have to come back to the manager for that. And if it continues the way it is, they'll have no choice but to pull the trigger. But you know, they're up against a side in Tottenham struggling for an identity. They're struggling to really bed in with their new coach. I mean, he's quite a negative defensive type of manager, same as Mourinho, and you wonder, you look at the resources and the players they've got available, you think, is that the right way for them to go? Ironically, a Brendan Rodgers who plays on the front foot would probably be somebody that would get the best out of Harry Kane and Son or some of the other attacking talent they have. But so it should be an interesting game to watch there, you know, watching the two managers and seeing what they're going to go through in the space of 90 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you mentioned Harry Kane there, and you just can't help but think that surely when, you know, sporting success is so difficult to define and so difficult to achieve when you're at the elite level, when all of the rest of his teammates know that he was desperate to leave, that surely there's a pall in the dressing room that, despite what appears to be a bloke that's trying as hard as he can, that he doesn't really want to be there.
Yeah, that must be difficult. I mean, they know he doesn't want to be there. He wanted to go to Manchester City. It didn't happen. I mean, he came out publicly so much as well, and that wouldn't have sat too well with his teammates, who, you know, are at the club and trying to build something themselves and have bring the success that Tottenham fans have been yearning. And it's a strange situation at Tottenham. It really is. I mean, the fact that they went through so many different options for the manager before they ended up with Nuno. And Nuno's not the greatest with PR as well. He's not brilliant with the media. And so he's not going to be sending out messages that are going to inspire not only the fans, but some of his players as well. He's not that guy that's going to be talking in the media about positivity and creativity and going forwards and having success. So, you know, they're going to have to buy into what he's saying privately in the dressing room. And I don't think Harry Kane, as the captain, is buying into that. He'll still want out in January, so we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, exactly. We will. It'll all play out in the fullness of time, Rob. And that is what we've run out of. Rob, thank you so much for joining us again, my friend. You stay well. We understand you've been going through some heavy weather back at home. So, mate, at least as long as the TV's working, you can watch plenty of football.
Oh, exactly. There's always football on.
Exactly, mate. There sure is. Rob Tanner, stay well, my friend, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Cheers. Thank you.
Okay, stick around on Box to Box. Stoppage time next to wrap up the show.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
This is Box to Box. What a great fun show it has been this week. We have gone from one end of the pitch to the other, as we always like to do. But before we get into stoppage time and wrap it all up, the fourth official has given us plenty of time to wrap it up. Our friends at Chemist Warehouse are getting ready for Christmas. Can you believe it? It's less than 2 months away. So you need to get ready for Christmas too, with Elfin good deals on these fragrances for men at Chemist Warehouse. There's SW23 Sport by Shane Warne, 100ml Eau de Toilette for $49.99. Ralph Lauren Polo Blue or Black, 75ml Eau de Toilette for $69.99 each. Paco Rabanne 1 million 100ml Eau de Toilette for $89.99. The young men will love going out nightclubbing with that. And Giorgio Armani Acqua di Gio 100ml Eau de Toilette for $109.99. Save $45 off the recommended retail price. You need to get into Chemist Warehouse. The boys know their big deals every single day, and the great savings, likewise, are every single day. All right, gentlemen, as we said, it has been a busy show. The Josh Cavallo story has been the prevailing one from start to finish. We'll bookend it with just a few final thoughts. Derek, where does this take us? I know I mentioned the Ian Roberts story, which is a local one. We did think back in the late 80s, early 90s, when he came out in the National Rugby League, that that might change things. It didn't. But the reaction around the world now, Twitter is generally considered to be a bit of a cesspit of the worst thoughts and cowards of this world. But sometimes it actually does some good. And I think around this story, it gave young Josh a platform to release and for other people to comment and just swamp any potential negativity around it.
Yeah, I think you're spot on in terms of the environment that Josh has made this statement, and compared to other players of various sports that have come out over the past few decades. And I thought Garby was great. It summarised it all really well. And we were talking there about, you know, is this the big change that we're looking for? Will it lead to other players? You know, maybe it's just part of who they are, and that there can just be just general acceptance of it. So let's see. Let's just hope that it's going to lead an inspiration, and hopefully the Josh is of a generation of, you know, of younger people that are coming through that have a slightly different mindset, a slightly more open mindset. And yeah, look, it's just a fantastic story all round. Well done, Josh.
I think the most incredible part of this, and it has been lost a little bit, is the fact that Josh is only 21, and sexuality is something that people grapple with far later into their lives, and even then it's not so public. So we've seen various players come out as gay. Thomas Hiltzbier, I think, Derek, was a German player, but he did so later in his career, not to remove the significance of it at all. Andy Brennan as well, but with respect to Andy, he was a peripheral A-League player. Josh is 21. Now, rightly or wrongly, he's going to carry the baton for hopefully not too long, but he's at the start of what will hopefully be a 10 to 15 year career. And if you watch his performances on the pitch last year, after a little bit of uncertainty at Melbourne City and Western United, I think a lot of people around him are pretty confident that he will have a 10 to 15 year career. So the fact that this has happened so early in his career speaks even further towards his maturity.
Yeah, I think you're right there. You know, the players that, and personalities that have come out have done it at the end of their careers, and I think that's because they're no longer in the spotlight, so to speak, anymore. They're not having to go and run out in front of 30,000-40,000 people. And as you said, the braveness here for him to come out and know that he had the confidence, and I hope that will be reciprocated by his teammates, his opposition, and the fans alike. You know, I've sat in the Emirates Stadium up until 2013. Homophobia was alive and well, and Arsenal was a pretty woke crowd by football comparison. It's just such a brave stand to do it right now, and that's where the inspiration really lies, Willem.
Let's roll on, Derek. I've made my thoughts very clear on Ronald Koeman as both Barcelona manager and future Dutch manager again. Where do you see this story this week?
Clearly, even though Barcelona are a cash-strapped club, and the thought of having to pay him out the millions of euros of his contract would have been something they would have liked to have avoided. The problem for them is that sitting down in ninth or wherever they are in La Liga, they just lost to Vallecano during the week, another disastrous result for them as the final straw. And Barcelona cannot afford to not qualify for the Champions League. Like, you know, they'll be realistic about what they'll achieve in La Liga and certainly in the Champions League this season, but they have to make the top four and they have to do something different. So unfortunately for Koeman, it wasn't to be. I felt like it was a poison chalice. And as I think you pointed out earlier in the show, I think this next one's a poison chalice as well. Xavi, I'm sure, will want to come in at the time that suits him, and come in at a time where it's you'll be maybe in a better position from a cash point of view, from a acquisition of players point of view, to make some quality signings. If I was him, I wouldn't go near this job at all. And by all accounts, he's not on great terms with the current chairman of Barcelona. He certainly backed another candidate in the last round of elections. So if I was him, I would stay well away for the moment.
I'm not sure how much English football Xavi watches. It's probably not beautiful enough for him, but he might be wise to have a look at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Lampard, Mikel Arteta at your club, Derek. Managers returning to their clubs where they were legends as players, and with less time between their playing careers, when they're still sort of wet behind the ears as managers, it doesn't have a great recent history. Now, Koeman, it didn't work for him, but I don't really consider him a returning son, because he's been away for a long time. He's had a long managerial career and set himself up that way. But for Xavi, I think, it has not been good recently for returning legends.
Yeah, look, there's always the exceptions to the rule. Zinedine Zidane, of course, it was a very accomplished career as a club legend. He did have more time at Real Madrid. He wasn't just sort of chucked in as a solution. He was with their B team and with their youth teams and did a fine job. I mean, I think most teams these days are chasing that Guardiola dream, as I like to call it. You know, he was the ultimate, the local boy, the club professional, the legends, maybe not like an absolute superstar, but certainly, you know, revered, and he lived the dream, and obviously took Barcelona to extraordinary heights. But as you said, it's very difficult to move on and sack a club legend. I think Chelsea had that problem with Lampard. I mean, they actually bit the bullet, got rid of him, got in Tuchel and won the Champions League. So in a way, you've got to credit them for that decision. Arsenal possibly in a similar position with Arteta, as you said. And I think the problem with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is it's like he is a club legend. He stuck out his foot in that penalty box in Barcelona, ironically, against Bayern Munich to send Manchester United into paradise in 1999. And how do you do that? But unfortunately, you know, if United want to be competitive and stay in the Champions League like Barcelona, you feel like that is the next inevitable move.
Well said. Okay, we're going to shift direction here and go to our man in the Middle East who's been filing these reports. Now, Edge, we do think he's going to be joining us from Doha next week and doing the show. So hoping all the tech sets up nicely for that. But just have a listen to this conversation he had with Richard Rashid Hussein from in Qatar about the setup for the World Cup.
Thanks, Rob. I'm here with Richard Rashid Hussein, who's an Aussie, believe it or not, with a name like that, who's been in the Middle East for 15 years, head of EMI Music, Sony, a whole range of stuff. He's a bit of a shaker and mover of the Middle East, and I'm actually out at the World Expo with him, and we're sort of cruising around having a bit of a look at things. And we thought it was an appropriate time to talk about how big the 2022 FIFA World Cup Qatar will be for the Middle East region generically. Now, Richard,
yes,
welcome to you and all the listeners, all the listeners all around the world that listen to us on our program. Can you, from a Middle Eastern experience, you know, from someone who knows the market very well,
yeah,
how big is it going to be and how significant will it be for the Middle East?
It's massive. They're building all the infrastructure at the moment and so exciting. The advertising is starting to start and it's really, really massive for the region. Hotels popping up like nothing. It's like really full on at the moment.
And I think a lot of people are losing the significance of the fact that just because the games are in Qatar doesn't mean it's not going to be big for the region. In particular, obviously, you are United Arab Emirates, Oman, Bahrain, but it's going to be significant for the Gulf and beyond that as well.
Absolutely. I mean, Dubai and the tourism has come, people have already booked out hotels for next year. So, I mean, it's really, really big. Massive. So, yeah, we're all looking forward to it.
Yeah, we are all looking forward to it. Now, we hear a bit of music in the background. You were telling me that there's a bit of a show on at the moment at the Expo, yeah, and you were telling me that this is a very popular religious artist who he does it right for himself.
Does very well. It's an artist named Sami Youssef. I was telling you I was looking at signing him in 2010, a little while ago. Very popular. They got great entertainment here across the board. They've had Andre Bocelli here last week and Ali Goulding, so it's all happening. Great entertainment coming through.
Certainly it's all happening. It's all happening in the United Arab Emirates, but really for our listeners to our the Box to Box podcast, to the guys back in the studio, we've only got one song. Damo, can you fix that little blip up?
Yeah.
We only have one item on our mind, and that's the World Cup Qatar.
Absolutely, Richard. Absolutely.
So I'm looking forward to take you a few games, actually.
Should yeah, I would love to, mate. Love to. Hopefully. So I'm looking forward to that. I've got some friends in Qatar and already got some invites and stuff. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay, thanks. Back to you boys in the studio from a very hot and sweaty World Expo here in Dubai.
Thank you.
Magnificent. Great to hear from Michael. I'm sure we're hearing a fair bit more from him next week. If I could just pinch a couple of minutes at the very end of the show, guys, to give a quick update on Ange Postecoglou and Celtic. Now, last week, Derek, you didn't scoff, but you weren't convinced by my claims that they'd win the league last season. Now, a few very optimistic Celts are dreaming about this season. They've moved to within 2 points of Rangers in first with a 3-1 win over Aberdeen. Rangers had to scramble to win a point. Celtic had a 3-1 win over Hibernian, while Rangers had to scramble from 2-0 down against Celtic to scrape back a point. I just wanted to touch quickly on Ange's back line. If you look across the back five, Joe Hart, Juranovic, Carter Vickers and Starfelt. Now, these are all guys who have been brought in his reign. And then at right back, there's a guy called Anthony Ralston. Now, going off the Celtic press and the local media, he's very much, Derek, the whipping boy. They think he's technically not up to it, and he does get caught going back the other way a little bit. But under Ange, he's scoring goals, he's getting forward, he seems to have his confidence back, and it's something we've seen over the journey at Brisbane, Melbourne Victory, and Yokohama, and to an extent the Socceroos as well, where he says, mate, if you can just fulfill this role for me in my system, I'm not worried about what anyone else says. If you repay me, I'll stick fat with you. And he's getting the best out of Tony Ralston, and that's the best of Ange's coaching coming to the fore at Celtic.
Yep, exactly. And we will talk more about that next week. We're going to bring Kieran Devlin on from The Athletic. All right, great work, boys. It's been a great show. Willem, thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Derek and Damo.
Derek, thanks for sitting in the chair. You'll be back next week in your normal pundit's position.
Yes, been keeping you warm for your edge.
Thank you, Damo. Join us next week when we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.